Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00062. Recorded on January 20, 2024. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Subarctic fucking wasteoid. Chapter 62.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88. This monologue is continued from the previous episode, 00061. Subarctic fucking wasteoid, part 1. And now, the conclusion of Subarctic fucking wasteoid.
I am a hurry up and wait guy. I will be early to meet you because I respect you, right? We set a time to meet. I'll be there early just in case something goes wrong on the way. You know? I do my morning commute like that. I'm always 15, 20 minutes early unless I get caught behind like the freight train crossing or something like that. I guess sit there for an extra 5 or 10 minutes. I still get there early. I'm never late to the job. And I'm not late when I'm going to meet you if we set a time, right? That's respect. And if you're the opposite kind of person that's late to everything, that's disrespect. You're disrespectful. Nobody likes that. Nobody's impressed by that. Don't be so busy that you're disrespectful. Yeah, I'm a hurry up and wait guy. And like this is the doldrums that we're in now. Like this whole cloud that we're under. Those of us who are in the know, and I don't mean to make myself sound special. It's just when you've been aware of the whole quote unquote New World Order people and their plans for like 20 or 30 years, right? Because they lay it out. They make it plain for anybody who's willing to look at it. You know what's coming. And you've been preparing for this. You hear that term prepper, right? It became very commonplace back when that scumbag McCain was running for president, right? And he had the vice president woman from where? Alaska. What was her name? Sarah Palin, right? Palin. And she was described as like a prepper type that lived out in the woods and shot guns, you know. And right around that time, you just started hearing that word, prepper, prepper. What are they prepping for? They're prepping for what's coming down in the next year. That's what we've been doing. We've been storing up food. We've been storing up ammo because we know something crazy is about to come down because the crazy people who are rich and powerful in the Western world got this dystopian plan, right? Where they want to kill more than half the population and then enslave the rest. The ones that don't die, they want to turn into zombies. That's why zombie has been such a prevalent part of our culture in the past like 10, 15 years. All those games, all those Call of Duty games with the zombie train and all that. The zombie movies, The Walking Dead. What is all that stuff? That's what they're going to turn you into to make you good slaves, right? But anyway, the doldrums. the people, the preppers in this world, who know what they were preparing for, right, know that this is coming. And between now and a year from now, there's going to be a whole lot of peculiar events that are going to lead to a crescendo, and the decision is going to be whether we remain a nationalist multipolar world, right? That's a Vladimir Putin's words, right? The multipolar world, or a unipolar world, right? What does that mean? Unipolar world is a world that's under singular control. A singular body controls everything. Now, if you know your Bible, your Old Testament, you know that shit ain't going to fly. You know God ain't going to go for that. You know the Tower of Babel and Nimrod? God doesn't go for this unipolar shit. So, odds are God's going to intervene at some point in a big way. Now, don't know what the timing of God's hand in it all is going to be. Is he going to allow for a unipolar world to start and then come and wreck it and break it up? Or is he going to kill it before it happens, nip it in the bud? That's God's territory, you know? But this is what we're coming up on. In the meantime, you've done what you can do to prepare. You've been ready for a long time for all this, and there's still time to go. And you don't really know what to do from this point forward, you know? You're pretty much where you're going to be. It's just a matter of marking time, right? Holding your position and waiting for orders. Waiting for the axe to come down. Waiting to take action. The doldrums. The doldrums. What are the doldrums? Right? You've heard that term before too, but do you really know what that is? That is a strip, a 10-mile strip around the equator, like a belt around the earth, where winds hardly penetrate just because of the heat, the constant heat of sunlight that bakes down on that belt, and what that does to the atmosphere. It prevents storms from the north to breaking the equator into the south, and vice versa, the storms from the south from breaking into the north. It holds weather systems in their hemispheres. Almost like it's meant to be like that. But if you're on an old sailboat like Christopher Columbus or Marco Polo, it's funny. It reminds me of The Sopranos, the episode where they're playing Marco Polo. Marco, wow, wow. Anyway, way beside the point, way beside the point. I may mention The Sopranos again later as we go, time permitting. I have reason to, and I just talked about that. It'd be very brief. But anyway, yeah, Marco Polo, Christopher Columbus, they all sailed the ocean blue on these big mast sailboats, right? Big old wooden sailboats. And if you were on one of those and you happened to cross by the equator within that 10-mile band, you entered into a place that had no wind. So you were just adrift, floating on top of the sea. Not in any particular peril, but not getting anywhere either, right? And it could be troublesome if you were caught up there way too long. You'd have to find a way out of it or hope somehow, some way, some kind of wind would cause some kind of current, some kind of storm would come close enough by to at least push you off to one side or the other, right? But that's what the doldrums are. It's just this belt around the earth, around the equator, where there's no wind generally. And for me, you know, we use that term to describe like a placid life where everything is in order, everything is boring, nothing is really happening, right? Not a whole lot of drama. Now, there's people in this world, lots of them, and trust me, being a recovering alcoholic, I've had my share of people and drama, right? And that's a whole nother story. It's worth telling, but not right here, right now. But if you don't have a whole lot of drama going on in your life, you're getting up, suiting up, showing up, doing your deal every day, right? Being a good boy, eat your Wheaties, take your vitamins, like Hulk Hogan said, you pray to Jesus, you go to work, you do your job, excuse me, life gets very stable. And in that stability, it's really just a slow go, drifting patiently forward. You know, it seems like doldrums. It seems inert, but there's things building up. You know, you're getting paychecks every couple of weeks, whatever your schedule is with that. And you're paying your bills, but there's some money not being spent. You're building up a nest egg. You're buying things. You're accruing things. Like, I've been a rolling stone my whole life with a broken meander in life. But here, I've been stable and steady in my marriage. With the church that I'm at, everything is just on a very even keel. No drama. We get disruptions. We get problems, like I talked about, the things that happen around the house, right? The two elm trees from hell, elm tree from the first hell, elm tree from the second hell. I've wailed about that 100 times already on these podcasts because that ate up a whole lot of time and resources in 2022 and 2023. It was real aggravation for me, and every time I bring it up, it's a real aggravation. It just never stops being that. That's what it is. And, oh, so sad. This woman had a whole bunch of balloons for a little girl's birthday, and they just let it go up into the sky, and it's going away. Bye-bye. Sad, sad, sad. So, I'm living this drama-free existence, you know? And we're just slowly trotting forward. And we're dealing with the problems that come along. We've had others, like I told you, the elm tree from the first hell collapsed a shed. That shed had to be ripped down, you know, emptied out and thrown away, you know. The yard got all burnt up. You've heard me about that. What you didn't hear, well, you heard a little bit. We had 3 chihuahuas. Now we have none. My beloved Coco, we had to get her put to sleep finally with her heart problems. It just got to be. Where she couldn't trudge along anymore. And very sad, you know. We had our hot water tank go to hell. We went like 6 weeks without hot water in the house while we were getting our plumbing system basically reconfigured to put a tankless heater up in the attic. So that's how we're going now. Now, that costs money, and there's issues with that, and da-da-da. The point is, there's something that's going to come along. But in spite of it all, because my wife is so even-keeled, because I'm so even-keeled, because we don't go in for the whole drama thing, our lives are stable. And as time goes by in that stability, it seems like you're in the doldrums, you know? Everything just kind of gets routine. But we have a good routine established where we're actually compounding things, accruing things, and things are good, you know? Now, she's not a drug addict, alcoholic. She's not mentally questionable, you know, anything like that. Where on the other hand, in my life, that has been a part of my history, right? And my history involves, when I get into these doldrum situations, it involves self-sabotage, right? I really am not good at being bored. I'm really not good at being inactive, not having a plan, a goal to achieve. I'm goal-oriented, and I'm very active-minded. And when I get caught in doldrums, this is where the fool steps forward in me, right? Like, I'm not a stupid person at all, right? I got a shitty accent. It makes me sound like a fucking clown. There's the F-bomb again. Man, oh man, oh man. Because I'm berating myself, right? Negativity again. I apologize. I do. I'm not going to be able to edit that out. I'm just going to apologize that. And anyway, in spite of my accent, I'm not stupid. I'm a fairly intelligent person. People who know me would tell you that. But somewhere in my makeup, somewhere in my constitution, I will get foolish out of boredom. I will go and look for trouble. I will go stir the pot. I will go create drama. Now, I don't look at it as going and creating drama. I don't look at it as like disrupting the lives of other people. I look at it like this. Hey, I'm on a journey, right? God's got me at a journey of self-improvement, which is ultimately a journey to sanctification, to righteousness, to holiness, to becoming Christ-like. And on the way, sometimes I get bored and I have to go play the fool. You know, I do everything right, everything is smooth, I get bored, and then I go do something stupid. I'm not stupid. I do something foolish, right? Excuse me. How do I explain this? I got this theory, okay? I got this theory on these lines. They're talking about the doldrums and hurry up and wait and marking time, moving through crowds efficiently. This part of my makeup, right? I get in these points in life where I'm in doldrums, and the way I look at it, and I may be wrong about this, but the way I look at it is, I call it the early arrival theory, right? I'm on this plan, this journey, like I just described. God's put out in front of me. There's things I got to go, directions, paths I got to take, plateaus I got to reach, whatever, toward this improvement, right? And it seems to me that I arrive where I'm supposed to be before where I'm supposed to be is ready for me to arrive. Capiche? Right? So I get in the doldrums, and it's like, what? I stand there and I look at a wall that's up in front of me, you know? I get to a sundial and I stand there looking at it until what? The sun spins around and the time changes and I'm ready to move forward into the next phase of development, right? The early arrival theory, it's like that. I kind of relate it like this because I've been going through this lately, right? I mentioned The Sopranos again, right? I just did a binge watch of The Sopranos. Whenever I get into a binge watch of some kind of television show, right? It is released in seasons, right? The first season, the second season, the third season, and all those generally are equivalent to a year, right? This year you have this season, the next season is another year, and then another year is the third season, and it goes like that. So I don't have TV. We don't have TV. We don't watch TV. The hell with TV. But there are some shows that I like to watch from the past. You know, they're bona fide, and they're good enough every couple of years or so to go and revisit. Now, Sopranos was one of them, and it's something I binged watched just recently, and I mentioned last episode about that in some detail. So what happens is you go to like an online streaming app like Netflix, like Paramount that I did for all the Star Trek stuff, for HBO Max had The Sopranos. You get one of those services, you pay a monthly subscription fee for them, and then you can binge watch. You can get an entire season or all the seasons depending on where it's at in its production, right? So what happens is, this happened to me with The Sopranos, everything. What happens here is you'll get your streaming app to watch a certain television program, production, and it may be like in the fourth season, right? It may be in the fourth season, which means that they have the previous three seasons ready to stream. So you can binge watch three seasons. And when you get through that, you have to wait until next year for the fourth season to be streaming on video, right? You're streaming on demand or whatever the hell they call it. Out of the theaters and whatever. And then the fourth season gets released. And what I do is I go back and watch either the previous season or all the previous seasons and come back now with a mind full of the stuff and then take in the new one. And then when you're done with the new one, the fourth season in this example, then you got to wait another year for the fifth one. That year of waiting is like these doldrums, right? It's like you're ready. You're ready for more. You've seen everything. You're caught up. You're to this point. You're ready to go to the next season, but the next season ain't ready for you. You end up in this holding pattern, right? So what do you do? What do you do with the time? If you don't go out and demolish the whole thing, doing something foolish, looking for trouble, like I did most of my life, and I don't do anymore, all you can do is kind of kick around over the same ground that you've already tread, you know, go back over to things that you have already done and just make what you can out of it. And this is where I've been, you know, that's where I've been. That's a lot of what this podcast is really all about. I'm kind of stuck in a holding pattern and I'm just kicking through things, you know. Here's my experience in the present and in the past. And I don't currently have much in the way of future goals to be working towards. I'm just living in the day and I'm remembering things of the past and connecting all those dots and everything like that. And that's what this is. This is marking time. This is doldrums. This is the waiting and the hurry up and wait. This is the holding pattern. And this is what I do. But thankfully, what I'm doing here is not destructive at all. It adds up to thoroughness, and that may be part of God's demand for me to be completely thorough, where I am so dang efficient at achieving objectives. You know, very streamlined from point A to point B, that there may be a lot of things that I would pass by in some sort of disregard that may be necessary for me to contemplate. So speaking of the binge watch, right? Like I said, I just did a Sopranos binge watch, and I decided I wanted to do a Better Call Saul binge watch again. And I say again because I went through that whole process with Better Call Saul. The first season came out, and I had to wait for the second one. The second one came out. I watched the first one, watched the second one, had to wait for the third one. Third one came out, and then I watched the first one, second one, third one, and I had to wait for the fourth one. I hate to have to say this, but waited for the fourth one, you know, and it just goes on like that until it finally runs its course. Now, we had gone through the fifth season, my wife and I, and we were waiting for the sixth, and somewhere in there this COVID era happened and all the weird commie, the homosexual pedophile strange stuff began to happen upon our culture, right? And I refused to subscribe to Netflix, which is the service, the streaming service that carries everything in the quote-unquote Breaking Bad universe. And that's what Better Call Saul is. It's a spinoff from Breaking Bad, which is also something that I have been binge-watched. In fact, my example of three seasons being out, waiting for the fourth, that was actually how it was with Breaking Bad, right? When Breaking Bad went to streaming, they had already had three seasons out on cable TV, AMC Network. Netflix picked them up for streaming. They put the first three seasons on that while the fourth one was on TV. I don't have TV. I watched the three, and then I have to wait for the fourth one to come back on Netflix the next year, right? And then go through that whole process. What really sucked about the Breaking Bad binge-watching experience through these seasons over the course of years was there was only five seasons, but the fifth one, they split it in half, and they released that second half of it the following year. So it was like a sixth season that you had to wait for. So the fifth one was just really short, and then the sixth one was really short, and you had to wait 2-3 years for all of it, and that sucked. But unlike The Sopranos, at least it ended great, right? The Sopranos ending was terrible. I don't even want to get into that. That's a dispute argument that you find on the internet and conversations all across the land, probably forever and ever, where people are concerned about The Sopranos. It was a blunt, stupid ending, period. Some people think it was great. I think they're really reaching, you know, as fanboys. As a fan of the show, I thought it was terrible. It just absolutely sucked. But Breaking Bad, on the other hand, was great. Great ending for Breaking Bad. And you know what? We finally got the Better Call Saul. I finally just said, forget it. I'll spend $13 or whatever it was, get ad-free viewing for 1 month. I'll get that sixth season that we never saw and see how that whole Jimmy McGill story concludes, right? Really did like Better Call Saul. Frankly, I like Better Call Saul better than Breaking Bad. However, Better Call Saul doesn't stand alone. You have had to have seen Breaking Bad to really get what's going on with Better Call Saul. It truly is a spinoff. It does not stand alone. So if you compare one and the other, you have to do that, that comparison with this fact in mind, right? That being said, when you have watched one and you watch the other, my preference is Better Call Saul. There's a couple of reasons for it. I don't really mean to get into the comparison of it, so I'm not going to, but I will say this much about it. It ended great. It was just a great, perfect, pleasant ending to a story. And it didn't really leave you wondering, what about this and what about that? There was really no open ends to it. Everything was kind of neatly tucked away. I would say that, you know, interesting thing about, a couple interesting things about Better Call Saul. It was both a prequel and a sequel at the same time. I've not heard people really discuss that interesting point. Even in the beginning, like in the first season, there was these little cutaway clips that didn't seem to make any sense unless you had idea from the Breaking Bad story that it's attached to and spun off from, right? So I say it doesn't stand alone. These breakaway clips would be done in black and white. The rest of the show contents, the story content, was done in color, kind of like the black and like what they did with The Wizard of Oz back in the 30s, right? It started out in black and white, and then when it entered into that the Land of Oz, everything was suddenly color. Really cool, really interesting cinematography and creativity, even all the way back then, almost 100 years ago, right? Breaking Bad did something similar. They made the use of black and white filming to separate time sequences. Now, what was black and white was actually future from the Breaking Bad story, right? It was a sequel to Breaking Bad, where Saul Goodman, the dirty lawyer, was spun off into a new life with a new identity up in like Omaha, Nebraska or something like that, and where he was running a Cinnabon stand in a shopping mall up there, right? That was his new hidden life, new identity life. That story was being told in just these little snippets going through all the seasons. And then when you get, and then everything else, the story that they were telling that was the prequel to the events of the Breaking Bad story was in color, right? The whole story was basically about this guy, Jimmy McGill, who was a dirty lawyer, and how he became a dirty lawyer. He took the name Saul Goodman as part of his marketing and practice. And there was a before Breaking Bad part of his story, and there was a post Breaking Bad part of his story. And what was added to the story, became really a central part of it all, was a relationship he had with this lawyer woman named Kim Wexler. They were boyfriend and girlfriend, and they eventually got married. Their relationship was a central theme to the whole thing. And in the end, it was about their relationship also. How their relationship basically ends. And the sixth season was done very much in black and white because it was telling the sequel tale of not just Jimmy McGill, but also of Kim Wexler. I thought it was great because the whole time I'm thinking, hey, you know, I know how Breaking Bad story goes, and there was no Kim Wexler there. She must die or something. And that would kind of suck. But what else do you do with that character? Oh, they came up with a great idea. And these guys, Vince Gilligan is the creator of the whole Breaking Bad universe. That's his baby. But obviously, he's got production staff that work along with them. And I'm telling you, that is a very artistic collection of film. These guys were incredible what they did, you know? And it's no wonder that they're considered to be like the most popular television show ever, or cable television show or whatever. I honestly think Breaking Bad, on the whole, as a universe, is greater than The Sopranos in the universe. I think Breaking Bad is greater than The Sopranos. I think the Breaking Bad movie is better. I didn't talk about that yet. El Camino is better than The Many Saints of Newark. Hell, while I still had HBO Max and didn't cancel the subscription, Many Saints of Newark was there to watch again. I've seen it before. I think I've seen it twice even, right? Again, I come from Newark. You're going to like that story. That story happens when I was a baby in the first couple of years of my life. I was there, you know, like I wasn't cognizant, but I was there. That's the backdrop of my existence, right? The whole white flight from Newark that happened, I was part of that. I was being dragged along by my parents, but I was a part of that. I put on Many Saints of Newark to watch. I got like 5 minutes of it, and I canceled it. I stopped watching it, and then I just canceled the subscription. I was done. I think I've had my fill of Sopranos. I think I've had my fill of New Jersey in general. I think I've had my fill of past. I think I've stomped those grounds to death. That's a personal side of it. But then you compare that to Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad was a work of art compared to Sopranos. Sopranos was like Howard Stern, shock jock. The best part of Sopranos was the shock factor of it all. But Breaking Bad was a work of art. And you know what? The further along it went, the better it got. Sopranos, the further along it got, the more it was just spitting at, regurgitating the same crap. And I'm sorry if you're a fan of that. I always was a fan of that. But it's just something clicked in me this time around. And I mentioned it last time. So anyway, yeah, Many Saints of Newark, forget about it. No pun intended there, but I guess I speak the language. But El Camino, on the other hand, this was the Breaking Bad movie, right? And I've seen it before. I think I've seen it twice before, in fact. This is a story that follows the line, the character arc of Jesse Pinkman, who's main character from Breaking Bad. He was the drug cooking and distributing a cohort of arch criminal Walter White, right, who was the main character of it all. Jesse Pinkman was like the comedic relief, and an excellent, excellent character. A young guy, right, late teens, early 20s, a street guy, as it was in the 2000s, with all the lingo and the clothes and the music. Great character, right? Well done, portrayed great. El Camino is a story of him. Now, this is a sequel to Breaking Bad. It picks up exactly where the last episode of Breaking Bad left off. This guy remained alive, and there was yet a story to be told, and Vince Gilligan didn't waste any time telling the story. He got the movie together and got the movie out, right? And Saul Goodman, he managed in the end to escape to a new life, a new world, way up north. North to Alaska, as the case may be, right? All the way to Alaska with, you know, $100,000, $200,000, bags of cash, new identity. And that's where his story leaves off. And I don't know that it's ever going to go anywhere past that, you know, at this point in time. And it was, you know, your regular hour and a half, 2 hour movie. And it got it all done. Let me tell you, it was great. There was only one thing in it that I didn't really care for, and it's not it's no fault of the creators. It's the creative staff, the producers, directors. No, they had an actor who's the exact right actor to have because it was a character that came from Breaking Bad. See, I told you this story, El Camino, picks up exactly where the last episode of Breaking Bad left off, and in that last episode, you were dealing with the family of this one guy, right? the bad scumbag family of this one guy, this young guy, who was just psychotic and a killer. And he was kind of scary in his own weird way, right? Kind of demented dude. And he was lean and mean and just had that look about him. I don't even know how to describe it, right? But he, you know, he's a villain. He's for sure a young kid, but an absolute villain. So you go from that day to like a day or two later where the story picks up. It's that immediate in time. And what happened in the course of production over a year or two, or maybe even three, the actor who played this dude, he gained like 30 pounds of weight, right? So he's all chubby and it didn't fly with me, right? A, you don't gain 30 pounds in 2 days. B, a hard-edged psycho young killer just ain't gonna be fat. I'm sorry, not when he was lean and mean 2 days ago. It just didn't fly, right? So I had to overlook that and get it. It was difficult because he was kind of a central character in this movie for a good chunk of it, right? But aside from that, and that's just the thing. I mean, what are you gonna do? You got to get that guy in the gym, maybe some bags of cocaine or something like that for a couple of months, get him in shape, and then start filming. But they didn't bother. They just got on with it as was. Still a great movie, really, really was. But again, you had to be familiar with Breaking Bad. It was absolutely a spin-off. It does not stand alone. But yes, I say it again, I'll say it one more time. Breaking Bad and all its spin-offs are greater than The Sopranos and all their spin-offs. And why do I say this? It's been kind of a disputed thing. You know, Sopranos was the popular cable TV show of the 2000s, and Breaking Bad was the popular cable TV show of the 2010s. And which do you like better? I guess leave a comment, but you got my opinion right here, right now. Now, in the El Camino movie, you know, something stuck out at me. It didn't really impact me, as I recall, in the prior viewings that I had of the movie. Walter White, now, he's the main character from Breaking Bad. He dies at the end of Breaking Bad. They did flashbacks in El Camino back into those days, right? And there was this one particular one. It was a flashback of Walter White and Jesse Pinkman sitting at a table in a diner having breakfast or whatever. And they're just having a conversation. This conversation didn't come up in Breaking Bad, but it did come up here in this El Camino. And something that Walter White said, and this is not word for word, this is not verbatim, but it's on the lines of, you know, he was talking, an older guy, 50 years old, 50s, maybe my age, talking to somebody who's like 20, 21, 22, right? And he said this to him. You didn't wait your entire life to do something great, right? So there's a little bit of, like, jealousy at Walter White. He knows in his life, if you know the story, he could have done something great when he was young, and he walked away from it as a scientist in a corporation with these partners that he had who were supposedly friends of his that took advantage of him and screwed him and all this stuff. But he had a shot at greatness when he was young and walked away from it because of all the aggravation, right? And of course I relate to that. I do relate to that on some level. But I also, you know, Walter White did what he considered something great at the end of his life when he got into all this distribution of meth, amphetamine, and making these millions of dollars to leave to his wife and his kid, right? To him, that was something great. And of course, Jesse Pinkman being a part of that was a part of that greatness. And Jesse was only, you know, 20-year-old dude, having had already achieved something of greatness, you know, a story to be told. You didn't wait your entire life to do something great. And I think about that. It's like, I threw so much away. I talked about my cousin, the original Canadian badass, right? as a very talented person with a very magnetic personality, but a chip on his shoulders and a deep-seated hatred that I share with him, right? All that stuff, all the above, I share with him outside of a magnetic personality. A magnetic personality I have never been accused of. In my nuclear family, my brother, right, the one who's a year younger than me, my full brother, he's got the personality. He's a charmer. People love him. Very popular, right? Good guy. I understand why. I'm not even jealous of it. I understand it. He got the personality. I don't. I got something different. And it's of its own value, right? But he got the personality for sure. So I differ from my Canadian cousin that way. I didn't have the personality, but everything, as far as talent goes, the possibilities, the opportunities, he threw his shit away and I threw my shit away too. And it's not for like a lack of pursuing things. He went out and tried all kinds of stuff. I went out and tried all kinds of stuff. Both of our lives have been meandering and broken paths that led us to wherever it is we are, where we are now, and what we are now. And because we're alive to tell it, it can't be all bad, right? There's something of value in this. There's something of value in me. There's something of value in him as a result of everything. We both had uncommon paths. Most people in mundane living don't get to see. They don't get to live all over their country. My cousin did. He lived all over Canada, East Coast to West Coast, you know. And he's back where he came from now, in the Niagara Falls, St. Catharines area. And me, I'm still out there. And I don't know that I'll ever go back to New Jersey, where I came from. But I've traveled around too. And we were, you know, two out of three who were like that, you know. We had another... Like I mentioned it earlier, and I don't want to get hung up on this again because I already talked about it. There was basically three families here in North America on the Ukrainian side, on my Ukrainian line. My father, his family, my uncle, his family, my aunt, her family. My aunt, her family was up in, the ones up in Canada. Uncle and his family were in Warren, New Jersey, and my father, his family... We were next town over in Martinsville, right? So we were close in New Jersey. Each family had their badass black sheep dude, right? The guy was a little crazy, a little off. And the guy who lived kind of a meandering and broken life, right? Traveling away from home, right? Like I said, the guy in Canada, he'd been East Coast, West Coast, all over Canada. He spent time in the Rocky Mountains in Banff, which is a gorgeous place. If I was to ever go somewhere in Canada, that's where I'd probably want to go. Maybe. I don't know. It might be upper crusty for me, too. I don't know about that. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. It ain't going to happen. My cousin from Warren, who was the black sheep of his little family, he left as a teen after a stabbing incident and went to Florida. He took off and was gone. Like, we didn't hear from him for quite a few years, and then he ended up coming back to Jersey, and you know, he didn't live a life of wandering like the Canada guy and myself, but he did have that early on in his being, where he had to take off and he lived out of state, far away from everybody, on his own, right? So we all got that in common. And that guy, I wouldn't call him talented. He's passed. He's gone now. I pray for his soul every single day. Well, most days. Days that I'm praying for the dead, which are generally five out of a week, to be clear and honest with you. I pray for the soul of those who have passed before me. He's one of those, right? He's gone through. And his brother as well, right? His brother was like a brother to me more than a cousin. Both of them died fairly young, in the 40s and 50s. And anyway, he was not talented in the same way that my Canadian cousin and I are. We have many diverse talents, a lot of different outlets, a lot of different roads we could have pursued. In fact, that's part of the problem with guys like us. You're good at a lot of stuff, and you just don't know what to grab onto and pursue and let go, because when you do that, you got to let go of all the rest, you know. that's an added complication to it all. I don't mean to get hung up on all this crap, but the fact is, in spite of all that I had personally, I threw so much of it away. It's a lot of wasted opportunity. That's what people would call it in this world, you know? When you want to get the most you can out of this world, out of this life in this world, and you have opportunity and you don't take it, it's a waste. It's a waste, right? Part of my problem, I guess you could call it some kind of just general indecision about what I wanted to really do. But the bigger part of the problem was something psychological. Like I had and I've always had this long-standing hatred for the world. I hated this world long before I even understood exactly why. I had glimpses, I had flickers of it, you know. Like Pink Floyd, Comfortably Numb. When I was a child, I caught a fleeting glimpse out of the corner of my eye. Now, I had these little snapshots of reasons to hate. I used to call it hate being alive, and this is part of the confusion of it all. As a kid, you don't really get what's going on, even inside your own dang self. I didn't hate being alive. I hated the world that I lived in, and I didn't understand what was so good about that exactly. But I was a rebel. I was actually a notable rebel. I've spoken about this in another episode or two. It's a fact of my life. I was voted class rebel in high school, and they made a plaque or a trophy for me and everything, right? That's who I was as a teenager. I was known as the rebel among rebels. And what I was rebelling against was never really quite clear. You can almost say a rebel without a cause, but the thing is, I had a cause, I just didn't know what it was. There was a cause, and it impacted my psyche, and I responded in kind to it, but only to a degree. It was kind of without direction, disjointed. The fire was there, the spirit was there, the rage was there, but the point of it all was missing, and that's the sadness of it. And what I'm starting to see now is, like, whatever my enemy really was back then, it's the same damn enemy that there is now. And this gets interesting for me, right? Because when I put it all together, I realize what it was that I hated back then, it was not my life like I thought. It was the world that I had to live in, that I hated. But what did I really hate about the world? As a 14-year-old, and my mother came to visit a couple of months ago, back in October, and we sat down with coffee at the coffee table, and we're talking about things, and she brought up how I had this problem with quote-unquote businessmen, right? I had something scribbled on the wall about F the businessmen. I remember scratching something into a shelf or a bureau or a dresser or something in my room that said pretty much the same thing. That's how I looked at it when I was 14. I knew that it was something about corporate greed in this world that was destroying this world, that made this world suck for me and for everybody else. Now, for most everybody else, they were kind of oblivious to it. You just did your thing, you got along, you chose your path, you found your talents, you found your interest, you went with it, you made your money, you lived your life, and everything was about you, your significant other, the children that you made, the children they make, and that's life. Then you die, and that's the end of it, right? For me, not so. Somehow, I had some kind of inherent vision that I can see that there was a great enemy out to destroy everything. The problem was that enemy wasn't ready to throw in, to put down and go for it until what? Now, right? So was my life a waste? I have figured out at this point who the enemy is. I'm still trying to put it in very concise terms, you know? And really hone in on where they are, you know, and where I can go knock on their door. Where their ivory tower actually is. But I know generally who they are, what they're about, what they're planning to do, and what the timeline looks like. and I still hate them all the same. It's just, like I said, the corporate greed, but the government criminality that ties into it, right? Because the government's really ultimately a corporation anyway. And it's all about greed. People, the worst people go into that arena. Isn't that remarkable? The very worst of us, the most pervert scumbags, I said perverted scumbags, have power as an incentive. They want to have power over people. Why? Because in the core of their existence is a deep-seated weakness that demands power. And then when they get the power, they are privately, not publicly, but privately, like that very strange kid that you had in your class who liked to catch flies and rip the wings off of them and just watch them walk around in circles and laugh and laugh and laugh. And he would graduate as he got older into like tearing the legs off of a cat, you know, shit like that. That dude ends up in politics. He doesn't end up like David Berserkowitz or Jeffrey Dahmer. No. You think that's where he's going, but no, he ends up in politics and government and, oh man, just because the weakest people crave power, and when they got the power, then they turn around and they torment souls with it. We are not, as a general public, completely privy to the fact of the scumbaggery that these global elites practice. But I am of the belief that these things are going to be unveiled soon, in months, within a year. We're going to be in a position where, as a collective whole, we are going to lay eyes on the truth of the filthiness of these people. And that's going to be a cultural upheaval unlike anything humanity has ever gone through before. You and I are going to get to witness these times. They are literally children of their father, the devil, like Jesus called the Pharisees, right? The chief priests in Jerusalem. You know, back then, when I was a kid, I remember, like, you're talking about this hatred of the world, right? I was aware. Now, I hated life, but I was also aware of hating the world at the same time. I had self-talk where I called it, I hate life, I hate being alive. And I ended up being a suicidal person as a result of it, right? I didn't want to live in this world. But I used to have, like, pins. I used to write. I remember freshman year in high school. We used to write on our blue jeans, right? Correct? There were a little pack of us. We were all high school freshmen. We'd go sit together somewhere, smoke pot, take pills. You know, there'd be girls, there'd be guys, and we would write on each other's blue jeans, you know, peace symbols and Led Zeppelin this. And I always had FTW on almost everything I wore. I had an old, like Vietnam era military, probably army overcoat, right? All wore out and everything like that. And I wrote all kinds of stuff all over it. There was a big old FTW, like on the lapel area. FTW, fuck the world, right? That was a part of who I was. That was an expression of who I was. And of course, like I said, I was a class rebel, voted so and everything like that. Funny thing, this guy, he's the younger brother of a guy who was in my graduating class. I graduated in 1985, a guy in my class. We were sort of kind of friends, right? Through the years, we played baseball together. When we were in the sixth grade, both of our little brothers were on our teams with us. It was the only year that I played baseball that me and my brother were on the same team, right? But also, there was another pair of brothers on the team, and it was this guy and his younger brother. Well, this younger brother, unbeknownst to me, we were all partiers, right, in high school. I didn't know, But this guy kind of looked up to me, and he explained this to me. He shared something online, like on social media, and he compared me to this guy. There was this, you know, kind of teeny bopper movie that came out that year, 1985, as it turns out. I thought it was after that, but it was actually 1985, and it was very popular amongst the kids because it was directed towards kids, and it's called The Breakfast Club, right? And I think the general premise, if I remember right, I've seen it once or twice. I kind of sort of get it. You had Saturday detention in some school, probably California, right? I guess that doesn't matter all that much. But you had a Saturday detention for kids that did something screwed up during the week. Saturday morning, they all had to come in, they had their detention, and this particular Saturday morning, the class, if you want to call it that, the crew at detention, they represented a cross-section of the student population, right? You had like the cheerleader girl, and you had the jock, and you had kind of like a dark vampire emo kind of chick. We didn't have a word for her back then, you know. But the one that always wore black and had the black makeup on and always was shoegazing and looking down. And there was that girl. And you had like the nerd, right? The nerd, the heady guy, the chess club type of guy. But then you also had, you know, their version of the rebel, right? And his name was John Bender. I would not be able to tell you that without having had looked it up, right? I'm not that familiar with it all. I mean, I could picture it. The actor was Judd Nelson, I think. I don't know. I'm not, you know, Hollywood guy. But yeah, John Bender was the character's name, and he was like the rebel dude, right? He was like the rebel dude. And I, like I said, I had picked something up to read about this character, and I'm going to read it for you, at least some of it, right? So hang on. John Bender is the provocative bad boy of the group, right? He stands out as the protagonist among the ensemble cast, stereotyped as a pot-smoking, socially isolated wastoid, right? Look at that word, wastoid. I don't know if I've ever heard that one before. That's some California shit right there. Right? Stereotyped as the pot-smoking, socially isolated wastoid, the grungy-looking. Remember I talked about grunge before there was grunge? There you go, right? Maybe this dude was right about me. Now, maybe my whole life is kind of tied up with this John Bender character. Let's read more, right? The grungy-looking Bender taunts and torments the other students, okay? As a dick like that, particularly Claire, who he targets because of her privilege and popularity, right? Okay, upper class, global elite. You see where this is going, right? Initially hostile, the other students develop sympathy for Bender when they learn that his aggression is a consequence of being raised by a verbally and physically abusive father. All right. Now, I wouldn't call my father verbally and physically abusive. He was abusive in different kind of ways. But my problem, my nemesis, was my father. So, again, here we go, right? Where was I? Bender also engenders sympathy for his mischievous behavior and rebellious confidence. That was me to a T. This dude was right. Listen to this part. He also protects the others from being caught out of the detention room by distracting somebody named Vernon away from the gym, not minding that he will get in even deeper trouble. That was me too. I took it for the team. It was a badge of honor. You could ask my brother about this. I covered for him almost daily while he was out doing his thing. I took responsibility for it all. If he was going to get in trouble for something, I did something five times worse and just took the attention away from him. And this was not competition. This was protecting my brother. Very strange, but let's see. Although Bender sexually harasses Claire throughout the day, Claire initiates a kiss with Bender, prompting him to suggest that a relationship with him would be an ideal way of getting back at her parents for mistreating her. Ooh, right? So that becomes a theme of Generation X, all this mistreatment of parents. It looks one way on this person, it looks another way on another person. Anyway, I'm going to cut it with that, right? Not to get it, there's still like another paragraph to read, but you see the similarities. Like this kid was kind of really right, maybe more so than he thought, definitely more than I would have thought. I was just like, you know, that's an actor portraying some kind of role in a scene, and it's like, oh, I was the real deal. And I'll be honest with you, that's exactly what I thought. I was the real deal. That was like somebody pretending, you know? And what that guy was into, what he was doing was not a tenth of what I was about, what others were about. All right, we got a tow truck backing up here in a very tight area, and I don't know what the hell he's intending to do, but I don't like it. Don't hit my truck. I don't want to have to shoot you. So, yeah, so John Bender, right? Breakfast Club, 1985. That word, wastoid. Wastoid. I don't know that I know that word. So, we break out the Urban Dictionary, right? I often go to dictionaries and Bibles. Here's Urban Dictionary. It has an entry for this thing called a wastoid. That's spelled, by the way, W-A-S-T-O-I-D. It looks like wastoid, but I managed to figure out. Now, they're trying to say wastoid, and how the hell else would you spell it? Wastoid. All right, here's one entry. A burnout of a burnout. It's like the burnout's burnout. A dreg. D-R-E. Excuse me, D-R-E-G-G, whose eyes are cased with the dried tears of their life. Wow, that's heavy. As they've realized all their dreams are unattainable except for the drinking part, right? Okay, I've been there, done that. Okay, here's another entry, wastoid. One who gets wasted. Okay, kind of generic. Wastoid, an 80s term for a drug user that is now only used by guys with mullets. Okay, again, I don't know the word. I did have a mullet at one point, though, in the early 90s. It just kind of worked out that way. I didn't even know it was called a mullet at the time. Wastoid, another entry. A person who really, I mean really, abuses drugs. Okay, all right. And here's one that says, human wastoid. Idiots that use the word gay as an insult, like it's a joke, when it's clearly a sexuality and can offend someone. Okay, that's way different than all the other ones. It seemed like it was missing the mark. But I'll tell you this, though. Like, even wastoids, low class as we may be, even wastoids look down on faggotry. So, yeah, my life was a waste, and I was a wastoid, and I blew all kinds of opportunities, and I was fighting phantoms and demons that were bigger than me and hidden from me, and that's all good and fine, but the error that I really made in my life, and this is worth noting, I hated the world. Like I said, I thought I hated my life, but I hated living in the world. I hated the world, but I blamed God for it all. I made God liable for the world, the conditions, the things that I hated, the things that made me miserable, because, you know, the creator of all things, he created the world that I hated. So it's his fault. All of my torment, all of my suffering, right? This is what I did. That was my reasoning. That was my logic. That was my spirituality as a young person. Of course, part of the reason that my father is my nemesis, because he was an atheist and he didn't bring me up in the manner of the ways of God. My mother tried. I don't think she understood it enough, and she came from the Roman Catholicism perspective of it all. Anyway, without getting into it. Through my father, I had orthodoxy in hand, and that's what I have come to. That's a conclusion I have come to as the right path, right? For me, for my wife, for everybody I know, I would definitely direct you there. Whatever you may think of it, you will find proper doctrine there. And proper clergy who aren't used car salesmen out to make a name for themselves, which is what we get pretty much otherwise. Believe me, I know. I've been down that path. I blamed God. I blamed God. I guess I blame my father as the paternal figure under God, too, right? And this is kind of heavy stuff. This is where a big split happens. See, all the evil in the world happens. It originates with Satan having a problem with God. He had a problem with God, with God's creation. He had a problem with humanity. He was envious of humanity. He was vain in his self-assessment. And these things were abominable. They tore him apart from God. Right? This was the incentive for him to turn his back on God. And that was the cut. That was the knife that slashed a gash into the divine order of things and brought sin into being. Right? God didn't create the sin. God didn't create the badness. If you go through creation, the story, day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, six, every day he created stuff, all the stuff he created, he saw that it was what? Good. Everything was good. What God did, everything was good. And it had intent. It had order to it. It had meaning. And then sin come into the world because this one seraph angel had a bug up his ass and turned away from God, right? And that ruined the divine order. And it brought evil into the world. This is heavy, heavy, heavy stuff, but it is what it is. But that's what the world becomes, right? And we all have that same personal little devil in us that does the same things. We can become compelled to turn away from God, and we bring sin into our life, and we bring sin into the world in the very same manner the devil did originally, right? But there's good reason to hate the world. Turn your attention once again to St. John the theologian, right? My patron saint, the beloved of God, right? The beloved of Jesus Christ. 1 John, right? Another letter, another epistle. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. Give me a second here to catch up. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. What was I going to say to you all here? I'll go New King James on you. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Okay? So that's it. The love of the Father, the love of God, is not in the person that loves the world and the things of the world, right? If I'm living for this place, like I talked about before, you know, ignorant bliss of just accruing stuff, creating your domain, and living for you and yours. Living and dying that way puts a person at greater jeopardy than a person even knows. Now, you could be kind, you could be nice, you could be very well contented with the success that you've had, the things that you've accrued, and that could put you in a mood that is greater than the general dismality that we experience as a collective, right? You could be very content with your existence when everything goes your way, you know? And the more well-to-do you are, the more control you have over that. You could throw money at problems, and you can make happiness where you were unhappy. But you're also doing that on your own. You're doing it of your own power and capability. Where's God in that equation? See, when we are self-sufficient, we have no need for God. This world is supposed to be somewhat torturous, right? There's got to be painful enough experience in our existence to cause us to look for God, to call out to God. The pain of existence should be a revelation of Satan and evil in the world, that the world is of. I say there's good reason to hate the world. See, when you understand what the world is as the opposite of the kingdom of God, now you can hate the world with righteous indignation, right? The anger that I had as a rebel, as a child, as an adult, to this day, there is a justified anger if my anger is at, quote-unquote, the world. Because the world is a bastardization of the intent of God's creation. Civilization, as we know it, is a lot more animal and a lot less civilized than the ordinary Joe would think of it. We are so far adrift from the divine order. We are so far adrift from the original intention of God as He created things that we don't even know right from wrong. I look at all this and I realize, you know what? In my whole life, the whole grand scheme of my life, not only am I too early to get to the job, not only do I hurry up and wait when I'm in the Marine Corps, not only do I move so efficiently toward my goals and destinations through crowds, I was way too early with my hatred of the world, the fire I had in my soul, to strike out against it. I have spent most of my life waiting for this moment to come. My time is almost at hand. I mean, there's a big part of me that sees this is what I was made for. When I was in my late 20s, early 30s, I got to tell you, I was hoping this time would happen then. I was lean and mean and big and strong. I was scary. And I was still just a little bit crazy. And frankly, I was still an antichrist son of a bitch. Which means my morality was very questionable. Which means when the shit hit the fan, I was apt to do anything necessary. See, now I've got that humility, turning my will and my life over to the care of my higher power, as AA says, right? As God as we understood Him, to be technically accurate. A lot of what I hurry up and wait for, moment to moment, is God. I'm waiting for God's input on what to do next. Now, I'm not saying God like sits down beside me in an F-150 mobile studio and has a conversation with me. There's nudges, there's directions, there's doors that close, doors that open, and I have to have some kind of inner sensitivity to all that to move, right? To move on. But I got this idea, looking over the whole entirety of my life, my character arc, right, as Chris Moltisanti would say, Moltisanti in The Sopranos. My character arc shows that I was ready for this at some level 40 years ago, but I was not completely ready. There was something that was there that was missing, and what was there that was missing is what I alluded to before, Christ in my life. Now I've got that. And I've had that for quite some time, too. But then what was missing from me then was the Holy Apostolic Catholic Church. And I don't mean Roman Catholic by that. I mean the Orthodoxy. Let me tell you, brothers and sisters out there, friends and foes, this matters. This matters. This.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Stalin Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Stalin Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at poststalin.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@poststalin.com.